This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Okay, and here we go. First, welcome back to everyone. It's been a while. It is Sunday morning, October 21st, picking up with our class series in the halachic process after a hiatus for the Chagim, where we basically last left off, or people haven't followed, was we set up, I guess, the premise of the authority structure for the rabbinic system. We started off, with biblical law, worked through, well, why do we do any of these laws? Ultimately, it's to fulfill God's will. We explained where does rabbinic authority come from, or at least a few theories of it, some ideas of rabbinic fallibility. And now that we have this idea that you have actual rabbis, so how does the halachic process work within the rabbinic system? So here's where we start really getting to the meat of what is the system. And the topic today is legislation and dissent. And you'll see why I included dissent in a bit, because if it's just the legislation, it's really, one or two sources, but it's important to understand the context and what happens with the arguments relating to the dissent after you, the arguments of dissent relating to legislation and how those things go together. Question already.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, did we do or will we do or are we doing the actual physical structure of the deciders? In other words, there's this court and that court and, how does it actually work? Was there one Sanhedrin that decided everything?
I guess we'll kind of get there. I mean, we'll kind of touch on that today. Ramatan lays it out a little bit more explicitly, like very much formulaically. It's hard to like piece together. I mean, we can, we can spend a week on that too, trying to go through exactly like how did that court system function. But let's get to at least first the theory before we get to like, here's the system. So, Ed, start us off with source number one in the section called The Power of the Majority, because this really underscores whatever it is that they did, why it ought to work.
And why do they record the opinions of Shammai and Hillel to set them aside, to teach the following generations that a man should not always persist in his opinion, for behold, the fathers of the world did not persist in their opinion.
All right, I should have announced that this is Mishnah 80 at 1:4, and we'll do 1:5 in a second. The question is, well, if you don't follow, the opinions of, like, if you're following either Hillel or Shammai, why do you record both? And the answer is that, you have to, it's to teach you, you don't always just stand by your guns. There are times when, you change your mind, right? Or at least when you have to, like, give in to other. My father used to say, if you're never willing to change your mind, you don't have a mind to change. Mm. Take 1B.
And why do they record the opinion of a single person among the many when the halakha must be according to the opinion of the many? So that a court prefers the opinion of the single person, it may depend on him. For no court may set aside the decision of another court unless it is greater than it in wisdom and in number. Now, how do you prove that you're wiser than the previous court?
It's like a good question. Yeah, continue though.
If it was greater than it in wisdom, but not in number, it may not set aside its decision, unless it is greater than it in wisdom and in number.
So Mishnah in 80:1-5 here in our source sheets here, 1B, is a really crucial, crucial Mishnah in terms of setting up the requirements here. First, you have the line. The question is, why does we even bother with rejected opinions, right? Especially if it's that of an individual when you have many. So the first premise is when you have an individual versus many, the law is like the many, meaning majority rule, right? That's one assumption in this Mishnah. Assumption two, and this is the really, big one, Ein beit din yachol levatel divrei beit din chaveiro ad shegadol mimenu b'chokma b'minyan. A court cannot overturn its decision, a previous court's decision, unless it is greater in wisdom and greater in number. Now, you ask a very good question of how do you, quantify wisdom and go about asking, start checking out. Now, the truth is the Gemara doesn't, as far as I know, it doesn't explicitly say one is greater than the, give you those measurements. It does, however, give certain, I think we'll see a couple later on, where where it said that a certain court was not greater, at least in wisdom or stature, than a previous one. You can also ask, what does it mean to be greater in number? Because the Sanhedrin, was how many people?
71.
The whole point is it's got to be an odd number, right? So how do you have greater in number if the Sanhedrin is of a fixed size?
Can't be.
Exactly. So Maimonides answers that, you know, the way that you have greater in number, and we'll see this when we get to the Maimonides part of this class, is that it's a matter of authority. Meaning, if you've got one court whose authority extends to a certain area, right, it'll still have the same number of, you know, 71 people, but just because you've got a court of 71 people doesn't mean everyone's going to listen to you, and we're going to see that later on, too. All right, so those are two really important qualifications, you know, to state up front here, right? But this is the core part of the legislation. Once you have a legislation by a court, in order for that law to be overturned, the mechanism by which it has to be overturned is another body of greater stature, at least, you know, greater wisdom and greater number, in this case meaning greater authority. Ki'ilu, today, the Supreme Court makes a decision. No court in the land can overturn the Supreme Court until the Supreme Court overturns its own decision. Say, Roe v. Wade, right? A lot of people don't like the Roe v. Wade decision, but that's law of the land until the Supreme Court itself decides to overturn it. If a lower court decides to say, yeah, I'm throwing out Roe v. Wade, people just laugh at them, all right? It'll get appealed up to things like, wow, you have no authority to do that, all right? So this is clutch here, because this applies to pretty much anything else down the line, and we're going to see a bunch of examples here. One, and then one. Yeah?
Like the question about wisdom, how do you determine which court has a greater authority?
Yeah. I don't know of an explicit criteria other than some sense of acceptance. I would guess it would have to do with, you know, if certain groups listen to someone. Like today, you know, let's say Rav Moshe Feinstein, you know, he's a good example. I don't know many people who can start giving bechinot to all of the people in Rav Moshe Feinstein's generation to say, was Rav Moshe Feinstein smarter than other rabbis of his day, or were other rabbis smarter than Rav Moshe? How do you even begin to make the judgment? What you can say, and this is more of a sociological type of answer, is that Rav Moshe Feinstein had a great deal of influence over a great number of people. So even if in the time of Rav Moshe there were other rabbis out there who were smarter and perhaps more knowledgeable, they didn't carry the same influence. That much you can kind of tell. All right? Dana?
Do we ever acknowledge or get into Ashkenazi versus Sephardi?
Not yet. Right? We're still trying to, you know, before we get into those types of fights here, we're trying to get, like, what are the basic of the halachic system, right? But now that we have this law basically set up, we can see how the Gemara kind of applied this. All right?
You mentioned Feinstein, but I'm thinking that I tend to do some rabbi shopping, although Black Hat rabbi once said, you can't do rabbi. I mean, who elected him, boss? So.
We can get there a little bit. We may get a little bit later in terms of the rabbi shopping question. But the point was more of George's question was, how do you know which rabbi has a greater authority?
The one that gives you the answer that you want.
Well, not necessarily, because you ask people like, who are, you know, the big rabbis of the 20th century? You know, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's going to come up, you know, depending on which community you're in. Some people might cite Rav Soloveitchik. Some people might explicitly exclude Rabbi Soloveitchik. Today, you ask people who are big rabbis around in the world, you might hear, you know, Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, right, chief rabbi of England. You know, he's got a lot of press. You might have, you know, a few rabbis in Israel. I'll tell you this. My name's not coming up in the conversation, right?
Yeah, so, but you give me the answers I want.
But the point, when you're talking about who has a greater, you know, authority, either greater authority or greater range of influence, it's not me, right? Okay. That's more of my. That's the point that I'm trying to mention. Yes, not everyone asked Rav Moshe Feinstein questions. I mean, Rav Moshe Feinstein said, here, there are rabbis all over the world. If I was a rabbi out in Kentucky, if I had a community out in Kentucky, my congregants aren't asking Rav Moshe Feinstein, they're asking me. Mm. Now, I might have more influence to a particular individual, but if you're talking about worldwide, I mean, I'm sure whoever was the rabbi in Kentucky back in the day was a perfectly fine person, but the influence was quite limited. Yeah, before we move on. Okay. Remember, there are other sources in this year.
Right. dealing just on an individual psak-by-psak basis for one person, for one person by one rabbi.
Yeah.
Do we ever get into my rabbi can beat up your rabbi, and therefore what your rabbi said is...
We'll actually get to something that like that much later on. But before you get into like the contemporary ideas of what is a rabbi, you have to know what is a halachic process by which to even evaluate. You know, how could you say like one thing makes sense and the other thing doesn't make sense? By what criteria could you even begin to judge? Right. So that'll take a while before we get there. George, could you take source number 2A? This is Beta 5A. To give a little bit of context here, and I understand there's a lot that's packed into this sugya. It goes on for a couple of pages. The very beginning of Masechet Beitzah deals with the two-day Yom Tov issue. And like, why do we have 2 days of Yom Tov today? And where Rosh Hashanah is, the Yom Ha'arecht is considered one long halachic day. And where this manifests in halacha is of a case of an egg. To explain, there's a rabbinic prohibition called muktzah called nolad, where something is born on Shabbat, like an egg is laid, right? Laid, not lain. Laid on Shabbat, it is prohibited to be used on that Shabbat. Now, let's say you have a two-day Yom Tov.
Why, because you're breaking something?
It's not that you're breaking something. It's because it didn't come into the world except on Shabbat. It's a specific rabbinic thing about if it comes into the world on Shabbat or Yom Tov, it can't be used on that day. So yeah. If you have a two-day Yom Tov, if it was born on the first day, it could be used on the second. But because they're considered two distinct days. But Rosh Hashanah is considered a Yom Ha'arecht, a one long day. So if it was born on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, then it would be prohibited on the second day of Rosh Hashanah because it's considered one long day. General rules that we'll need to do just to understand this Gemara. Continue. Yeah. Okay. So I guess start us up here.
Rava said, since the enactment of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the egg is permitted to be eaten on the second day. For we have learned after the destruction of the temple, and since the temple has no longer existed, the reason for the previous enactment falls away. Rabbi Yochanan enacted the testimony, which I guess concerning the appearance of the new moon, should be admitted the whole day.
You want to take it? The rest is going to get a little bit...
What's in the square brackets?
Skip the square brackets are Cincino's footnotes, right? But the main point here is that you had a decree that was made that was relevant in the time of the temple. Temple's destroyed. It is no longer relevant. Continued to, after the breaker, it said Abaye to him. After the brackets, after permitted on the 31st.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, down here.
Yeah.
But if no witness came on the 30th, the 31st would be the...
Further down.
Said Abaye to him.
Said Abaye to him.
Yeah.
But have not Rabbi and Samuel both said that the egg is forbidden? He replied to him, I quote to you, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and you tell me about Rav and Shmuel.
Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai was the greater authority. So here's the case where you've got different rabbi, and here's you've got that level of authority here, where Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai was considered greater than Rav and Shmuel.
Yeah, but this guy's looking for a
one
loophole,
second.
So he doesn't want to know from that.
1 second. Continue.
But for Rav and Shmuel, our Mishnah is a difficulty. There is no difficulty. This applies to us, but that ruling applies to them. The enactment of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai could only affect the Palestinian, where only one, day, for example, the 30th, would now be regarded as the new year. However, late the messenger came on that day, but in Babylon and all places outside Palestine, the observance of the 2 days was not affected by the enactment of Rabbi Yochanan. For there, the 2 days were kept holy by the early rabbinical enactment and were regarded as one continuous day of holiness. But Rabbi Joseph says that from the time of the enactment of Rabbi Yochanan, ben Zakkai, and onwards, the egg is prohibited. What is the reason? It, referring, I guess, to the egg.
The prohibition of having the egg on the second day.
The prohibition of the egg on the second day, and whatever was forbidden on the...
Wait, it's a matter decided by a majority vote. That's an important line there.
Okay. Whatever was forbidden by majority vote...
Yeah.
...requires another majority vote to permit it. Even though the reason for its prohibition no longer exists, the prohibition still holds until a further vote in the assembly had been taken and declared it now permissible.
Right.
And as no such vote had been taken, the status of a status quo remains. That is, the prohibition of the egg is still binding. Sanhedrin 59.
Right. So we're gonna see that source that's cited here. So after all that, the main line, the clutch part of this particular passage is, and the real takeaway is, you had a prohibition that was real enacted for a particular reason, a particular time. The reason is no longer relevant, and yet the law is still binding. Why? Because since it was done through an act of legislation, you need another act of legislation in order to overturn it.
But why did they have a difference between Palestine and Babylon?
That was a theory that was suggested and then later rejected.
In the United States, there's supposed to be a vote of Congress to declare war, but a lot of presidents just... They don't mention the word war, and they send out the troops.
Well, that's bypassing, meaning,
yeah,
but that's something else.
It works.
This isn't the same issue of bypassing. I'll tell you what a better example in the American legal system. You have a whole lot of antiquated laws that, unless they are actually overturned or legislated out of existence, are still on the books. I remember reading a case where there was, I think it was in Pennsylvania. You had a married couple. The wife had an affair, got pregnant from the affair. And her husband, meaning the person on whom she cheated, was found to have legally culpable, liable for child support. Because according to Pennsylvania law at that time, is that as long as you were married, the assumption was the kid was going to be of the husband's, even though DNA can prove otherwise. And the court said, well, even though we know this not to be true, this is the law in the books. The law is upheld. Until the legislature overturns the law, this is what you got to deal with.
Who got socked with the bill?
The father. The husband. The husband, not the father.
Not the father.
Not the father. Sorry, the husband. Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
But that's how legal systems work. The law is the law until you need a formal action to overturn the law, even if the reasons no longer apply. And it doesn't matter whether or not it's enforceable. It could be enforced. Right?
Well, my comment is it's blind obedience. It's,
well, you need
the
to,
law is the law. Yeah.
You need to have a legal system in order to have like any sort of stable society. Thomas, could you take number 2B? This is Bates of 5B. This is the next page continuing kind of on the theme. To explain the context here, this is talking about the Shloshet Yemei Hagbalah. The 3 days before the Torah was given, there had to be separations amongst the Jewish people. We're not allowed to have, couples were not allowed to have relations with each other. We're told to stay away a little bit from the mountain. So start us off there. This is Beit Ha 5b. Go ahead.
What is meant by, and scripture for this is, the question here is, how do you infer from the first passage of scripture the principle that a prohibition once made is absolutely binding until it has been rescinded? And if the inference is satisfactory, why is it necessary to have a second scripture text? Rashi.
Yes, that's Rashi's explanation. So you've got two verses here. One verse is, prepare yourself for 3 days. And then in Deuteronomy, when it explains, it says, go and return yourselves to your tents. So the question is, well, why does it have to tell you to return to your tents? So the Gemara answers, Kol davar shebi minyan tzarech minyan acharav la'atiros. Like, so you have to go back. Continue.
Rashi, he means this, consider it is written, be ready against the third day, come not near a woman. Then what is the purpose of go say to them, return me to your tents? Infer therefrom that every prohibition decided by a majority vote requires another majority vote to rescind it.
So the implication here is that even though God said stay away specifically for 3 days, which is, let's say, a decree that was made with a specific time limit on it, you still needed permission to go back afterwards. Right? Because since you had that perceived as legislative act, was stay away, Even though the time passed, you still need permission to go back.
That doesn't
continue?
Make sense to me.
One second.
3 days I was away, God said, no, God didn't say I can't return, so I'm returning.
Well, that's the point here. It shows that the main point isn't so much the time limit attached to it, as much as the fact that you can't do something. At least
who
this is how this.
I can't do something?
Well, in this case, it actually is God. So, yeah.
He said it?
Well, yeah. When it says, Exodus 19, if you want, I can give you the full context. And we'll do that.
As a command concerning his general duties, then come and hear. When the trumpet soundeth long, they shall come up to the mount. Now consider, it is written, neither let the flocks nor herds feed before that mount. The expression before that mount is interpreted as meaning that mount covered with the cloud of the divine presence, from which it might be inferred that only as long as the cloud of the divine presence remained over the mountain, no man or beast could draw near. But when the cloud was removed, the people might, by their own inference, have thought that they might now ascend to the mountain. Then what is the purpose of when the trumpet soundeth long, they shall come up to the mount? Conclude therefrom that what has been prohibited by a majority vote requires another majority vote to rescind it.
Okay, so let's stop there. Then the Gemara continues, going back to the case of the egg, in terms of how it also applies to rabbinic cases, and then there's a discussion about which part do they actually have a majority vote on. Takeaway, at least from here, is at least, as the Gemara is understanding it, is that even though, here's the actual verse, this is Shmot, Exodus 19, 11, and 12, Yom HaShlishi, let them be prepared for the third day, the third day God will descend the sight of the other people on Mount Sinai, and you shall set boundaries for the people, saying, you should stay away from the mountain, whoever touches it will die, etc., etc. All right, so, continues here. V'yad Moshe Manhar goes down, V'kadesha Ta'am, sanctifies the nation, V'yichabesu Simlotam, wash the clothing, V'yomer El Ha'am, Heyu Nechonim L'shloshet Yamim, you should prepare yourself for 3 days, Al Tikshu Elisha, do not come near a woman. So that was the requirement for 3 days. All right, so, point is that even there, where you have a specific time limit, you need, God says, okay, now go back. The inference is, even if the reason no longer applies anymore, the law is still there unless you have explicit active legislation to overturn, finally.
But isn't it the court that institutes the law the court that has to overturn it? So if God says, don't come near a woman for 3 days, it would be God who instituted the law who would have to rescind it, not a human court.
Yes. Your point is well taken, that you're talking about a divine decree, and you're not saying that God is a davar shebi minyan, that would actually, get you killed in certain generations. You're certainly labeled a heretic to say that God is, innumerable. I think it's more of making, by extension of the analogy. And then it continues, later on, like, oh, that applies to biblical stuff, what about rabbinic stuff? It's a great question about how do you have a biblical pasuk be considered a davar shebi minyan? Yeah.
God commanded us to afflict our souls starting in the evening of the 9th of Tishrei.
Yeah.
Did he command us to stop on the evening of the 10th?
So that, we've got Gemara's on that too. Yeah.
Yeah, by me, it's like God said, stay away from a woman 3 days. He didn't say anything more than that. So if I want to sneak back to a woman on the fourth day, I'm not going to wait for a bunch of rabbis to give me permission. I won't even ask the question.
Because
they might say no, and they will.
Well, first off, not necessarily. You could say that it's almost automatic. This is the way the Gemara is at least interpreting this is a matter of legislative procedure, right? Which is a way of saying 3 days are up, now it's fine. Right? So even though it's almost automatic, it's still having that declaration. We said 3 days. 3 days is up. Yeah. Thought you had a question. Okay. Yeah, you want to read? We're up to source number 3, Sanhedrin 59b, which was referenced in one of the footnotes here. Go ahead. Just read the English, if you'd like.
Okay. I just need to tell you that I have a funeral to go to at 10 o'clock today.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Quietly, you will know it's not because of
me. Not a problem. Thank you for coming. Good to see you.
I'm happy to be here. I'll have to come again.
Please.
Okay. Sanhedrin
59b.
But procreation, which was enjoined upon
The Noahides. The context of the Gemara here is talking about the Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noah. And the question is, wait, is it only these seven? What about Peru Uravu? So you read in last week's Parsha, God told Noah, Peru Uravu, go and procreate and fill up the land. Why isn't that considered one of the Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noah? So continue.
For it is written, and you shall be fruitful and multiply and repeat it in exile, as it is written. Go say to them, get you into your tents again, but nevertheless commanded to Israel, but not to the heavens.
Heathens.
That repetition was to teach that whatever has been constitutionally forbidden by the majority vote requires another majority vote to
abrogate it. Right? So it's using that same pasuk here. It's like, why did God, the same derasha that we saw in Beitza applied here elsewhere as a reminder that the reason why you have that extra verse to go back to your tents is to show that whenever you have a majority vote, you need another explicit decision to overturn it. Dana, take 36b.
The question was raised, when Hillel instituted the Prosbul, did he institute it for his own generation or only or for future generations also? What's the practical bearing of this question? Should desire to abolish it. If you say that Hillel instituted the Prosbul only for his own generation, then we may abolish it, but if for future generations also, this would not be easy, since one Beis Din cannot annul the decisions of another unless it surpasses it in wisdom and in knowledge.
Alright, so here we've got another interesting quirk here with the Prosbul. It's a sugya afterwards, which I didn't want to get into, but just the very question for our purposes is important. Right, so Hillel, when he made the Prosbul, it could have been a temporary type of thing, or it could have been, I am making a formal declaration. What would be the difference? Well, what type of legislation it was. Right? Because if I say, this is something that's only locally, then I'm not really making the same type of decree as if I'm using the entire court. Right? Example would be, let's say I'm a rabbi of a synagogue, and I'm a rabbi of a local vod. Right? Meaning a bunch of rabbis get together and, make communal policy. I can set one policy for my synagogue, right? And that could be the intention. Or I go out in the Vod and say, this is applicable elsewhere. This comes up a bit with Rav Soloveitchik. There was one person I know who said, don't tell me what Rav Soloveitchik said in Shir. Tell me what he did in Boston. How did he actually apply halacha? But you could also say, what he did in Boston might have been appropriate in Boston, might not have been appropriate for, say, everyone in all time and place. What would be I'm not saying that Rav Soloveitchik was a Sanhedrin. I'm giving just the analogy of what would be the difference between the localized versus a generalized. They're very specific, are you talking about the national legislation using your official power saying, hey, I need to do this right now because it's needed? Right? And the difference is, if it's just a short-term thing, it's it's easy to blow off. We have no intrinsic obligation to do so. But if he did it through the power of the actual court, then what that means is you can overturn it. Additionally, the very fact that there's a question on this shows the main difficulty we have. Unlike Congress, which has a congressional record, and even though most people are too lazy to look up, legislative records, they're public votes. There are nice records of this sort of thing. You don't really have that for the Gemara. You'll have instances, and we'll actually see a little bit later about some discussions, and some voting taking place, but we don't have formal, I don't know what the adjective of Sanhedrin would be, but we don't have the congressional rules of the Sanhedrin, who voted for what, here was the vote. We don't have those records. And the very fact that they asked the question, what did Hillel intend, shows that even back then, there was, wherever this sugya was even put together, over many generations later, it was a lot closer to Hillel than we are. There was some uncertainty as to what was really meant that has to sort of be extrapolated somehow. Mm-hmm. Yeah? It's an interesting little quirk that we have in a problem in the system. One hand, we really want to follow the majority. On the other hand, there's a lot of guesswork because we don't have, explicit records and roles. Yeah?
This relates to a Prosbul. What's a Prosbul?
The Prosbul is Hillel's document to bypass Shemitah, where instead of, normally during the Shemitah year, your loans get annulled, and the problem was people weren't lending out money because, you could have a poor person that goes to a wealthy person, day before Shemitah year and say, hey, let me borrow, $100,000, right? Knowing that in a day, not going to have to pay it back. So there you go. So Hillel instituted the Prisbo, which basically transferred the debts from the private holding of an individual to a Beit Din, and apparently the Beit Din's debts do not get overturned, do not get annulled automatically by Shemitah. So, yeah. So, Dan, and we're finally up to this. I know you've probably been waiting for this. I don't like using the idiom famous Gemara, but if there is a famous Gemara, this is going to be it. Certainly should be number one on your list. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Gemara Bava Metzia 59b. You probably have heard of this in some context or another.
It has been taught. On that day, Rabbi Eliezer brought forward every imaginable argument, but they did not accept them. Said he to them, if the halacha agrees with me, let this carob tree prove it. Thereupon the carob tree was torn 100 cubits out of its place. Others affirm 400 cubits. No proof can be brought from a carob tree, they retorted. Again he said to them, if the halacha agrees with me, let the stream of water prove it. Whereupon the stream of water flowed backwards. No proof can be brought from the stream of water, they rejoined. Again he urged, if the halacha agrees with me, let the walls of the schoolhouse prove it. Whereupon the walls inclined to fall. But Rabbi Yehoshua rebuked them, saying, when scholars are engaged in a halachic dispute, what have you to interfere? Hence they did not fall in honor of Rabbi Yehoshua, nor did they resume the upright in honor of Rabbi Eliezer. And they are still standing thus inclined. Again he said to them, if the halacha agrees with me, let it be proved from heaven. Whereupon a heavenly voice cried out, why do you dispute with Rabbi Eliezer, seeing that in all matters the halacha agrees with him? But Rabbi Yehoshua arose and exclaimed, it is not in heaven. What did he mean by this? Said Rabbi Yirmiyah, that the Torah had already been given at Mount Sinai. We pay no attention to a heavenly voice, because thou hast long since written in the Torah at Mount Sinai, after the majority must one incline. Rab Nathan met Elijah and asked him, what did the Holy One, blessed be he, do in that hour? He laughed with joy, he replied, saying, my sons have defeated me, my sons have defeated me.
This is an incredibly rich, rich narrative, and you have literally books, you know, written or based on this particular passage here, of, you know, when a voice from heaven comes down and says, the law is like so-and-so. And the answer is, Lo b'shamayim hi, the Torah is not in heaven. You already gave us the Torah. The Torah says majority rule. That's it. And God laughs afterwards, you know, my sons have defeated me. You know, it shows at least the importance of a majority rule in the halachic system, right? I mean, there's a whole lot that can be extrapolated, but the point, at least underlined here, yeah.
Was he excommunicated?
Yeah, it gets an ugly, yeah, there's a lot more to the story afterwards.
There is a lot.
Yes, but for our purposes, you know, just stopping right here shows the force of majority rule. Wow, we're running a little late, so I'll take on a bit here.
Who's the guy that said Loba Shemayim?
Initially, it was Rabbi Yehoshua. Very good catch, because he's going to come up again.
And he's the guy that got excommunicated?
No. Rabbi Eliezer, because, yeah, it's a really, really fun story. Well, not for him, but, you know, for us studying. Mishnah in Shabbat 1:4 says, these are the halachot which they stayed in the upper chamber, Hananya ben Chizkiya ben Garon, and when they went up to visit him, they took account, and Beit Shammai outnumbered Beit Hillel, and on that day enacted 18 measures. So here's a really fascinating case, where there was one day they actually got together, and the numbers of Shammai outnumbered Beit Hillel, and Beit Shammai rammed through legislation. The Yerushalmi has a different list of 18 measures, and the Bavli actually disputes what those 18 measures were. But it did get ugly. Here's the Gemara in Shabbat 17a. When one vintages, when grapes for the vat to manufacture wine, Shammai maintains it is made fit to become unclean, while Hillel ruled it is not made fit. And there's a question about something being able, ra'ui l'kabel tuma, can it, you know, receive impurity or not? Something that, you know, today seems, you know, almost anachronistic. We're not that concerned with purity or impurity today. Back then was a huge deal. So said Hillel to Shammai, why must one vintage grapes in purity, yet not gather olives in purity? If you provoke me, he replied, I will decree uncleanliness in the case of olive gathering too.
A spiteful character.
A sword was planted in the Beit HaMidrash, and it was proclaimed, "He who would enter, let him enter, but he who would depart, let him not depart." And on that day, Hillel sat submissive before Shammai like one of the disciples, and it was as grievous to Israel as the day when the golden calf was made. Now Shammai had enacted this measure, but they would not accept it from him. But they, but their disciples came and enacted it, and it was accepted from them. So when it was just a matter of Hillel versus Shammai, you know, easy to overlook. When the students came in of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, Shammai won, right? And it's a really weird way to view this, because then we'll get to a little bit more about the disputes between Hillel and Shammai in a second, which is where you, which is why I wanted to include the dispute part too, because they come up a bit. But here you've got a case where the majority of the day happened to have been Beit Shammai, right? And they were able to pass anything through. As you remember from the last election, elections have consequences. Voting matters, yeah.
Was it by numbers or was it by authority?
Seems by numbers in this case. It was the exact same institution, court, so you can't say it was gadol b'chokhmah in some way.
What about the opposition's authority?
Apparently, because when they were all of the equals, then when you're still debating it, majority rules. Now, you could ask, well, if this was such a big deal, why not wait until Beit Hillel outnumbers Beit Shammai and overturn it? Wouldn't that make sense? And my guess would be is that just like in today's legal system, it's a lot easier to pass a legislation than to overturn a previous legislation. In fact, I know someone tried arguing that we could actually do much better if we put an automatic 5-year limit on every law, such that instead of just like keeping with laws on the books, sort of like force legislators to keep on coming to terms with, is this really necessary? Because no one goes back and think about things. But this is what they had to deal with. Let me continue. We'll go on. Ed. So we're up to the section on Hillel versus Shammai, right? Because we have some very interesting things here about the halachic authority and majority, you know, rule with such things. Gemara in Erevin 13b has an important Gemara in this dispute.
Rab Abba stated in the name of Samuel, "For 3 years there was a dispute between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. The former asserting the halakha is in agreement with our views, and the latter contending the halakha is in agreement with our views." Hmm. Then a bas kol issued announcing, "The utterances of both are the words of the living God."
Meaning both sides are legitimate, but...
"But the halakha is in agreement with the rulings of Beit Hillel. Since, however, both are the words of the living God, what was it that entitled Beit Hillel to have the halakha fixed in agreement with their rulings? Because they were kindly and modest. They studied their own rulings and those of Beit Shammai and were even so humble as to mention the actions of Beit Shammai before theirs." But I have an objection right here.
Yeah.
The bas kol, it's supposed to be disregarded.
Ah, excellent.
Making a big deal
out. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. No majority rule here. Fantastic. George, take the next source, which is going to address that question.
Okay, the question is, what did they do during the 3 years that they were arguing? What was the ruling?
Read the next source. It's the reason why I have it this way. This is Gemara in Erevin 6b. There's a parallel sugya in Chulin 42. But, yeah, go ahead.
Was it not a fact? In fact, taught the halakha is always in agreement with Beit Hillel, but he who wishes to act in agreement with the ruling of Beit Shammai may do so, and he who wishes to act according to the view of Beit Hillel may do so. He who adopts the more lenient rulings of the Beit Shammai and the more lenient rulings of Beit Hillel is a wicked man, while the man who adopts the restrictions of Beit Shammai and the restrictions of Beit Hillel, Scripture said, "But the fool walketh in darkness."
Right, so stop there for a second. So in a nutshell, I mean, this is a bit with rabbi shopping, where according to this, this one here, statement, follow, you know, if you follow the leniencies of Hillel and the leniencies of Shammai, you're wicked. If you follow the stringencies of both, you're an idiot. Very important for today, too, when it comes to rabbi shopping.
So I'm wicked.
Well, you don't always look for the lenient ruling. Go ahead.
A man should rather act either in agreement with Beit Shammai both in their lenient and their restrictive rulings, or in agreement with Beit Hillel in both their lenient and restrictive rulings.
Yes, meaning pick a side and stick with it. All right, so it's not a matter... Yeah, okay?
It is not this self-contradictory. You said, the halacha is always in agreement with Beit Hillel. And then you proceed to say, but he who wishes to act in agreement with the ruling of Beit Shammai may do so. This is no difficulty. For the latter statement was made before the issue of the Bat Kol, while the former was made after the issue of the Bat Kol. And if you prefer, I might reply, both the former and the latter statements were made after the issue of the Bat Kol, but the latter represents the view of Rabbi Joshua, who does not recognize the authority of the Bat Kol.
Stop there for a second. See? Ed, you picked up on this. Rabbi Joshua doesn't recognize the authority of the Bat Kol. Turning into a London, right? You're recognizing the important questions here, right? So Rabbi Joshua is the one who yelled out Lo Bashamayim He, right? So, all right, continue.
And if you prefer, I might reply, it is this that was meant. Whatever you come across, two Tanas and two Amaras, they differ from one another in the matter of the dispute between Beth Shammai and Beth Hillel. A man should not act either in accordance with the lenient rulings of the one master and the lenient rulings of another master, but in accordance with the restrictions of one and the restrictions of the other. But either in accordance with the lenient and restrictive ruling of the other, or in accordance with the lenient and restrictive rulings of the other.
Right. So this kind of answers your question. What did people do? Well, the answer was, it seemed, pick a side. Rabbi Joshua's statement's really fascinating. Because according to Rabbi Joshua, the fact that the Bat Kol came down has absolutely no halachic significance. Does that mean that Hillel, you know, over Beit Shammai? Well, it seemed to be normally Hillel, you know, over... how to put this? Based on the previous source that we saw, it seems that the numbers mattered more, right? But in a weird way, if you're like living in that generation, it could very well seem to be kind of arbitrary. Meaning, is it just because the fact that one day more people show up to shul for one team, then the law is going to be that much different? You come out with a Bat Kol, it sort of imparts a much greater significance to the position of Beit Hillel. It's like, okay, that's why we follow Beit Hillel over Beit Shammai. Not because the average person who doesn't know that much, in the time of the Gemara, not that many people, and you didn't have anything written down, so you either knew it by heart or you didn't know it at all, you really studied, isn't going to really know the nuance in terms of why is Beit Shammai's logic worse than Beit Hillel's logic. It's like, oh, a Bat Kol came down, right? You know, that's your answer for it. But a Bat Kol has no intrinsic halachic authority.
It's
and the echo from heaven, kol meaning the voice from heaven. There are a few Gemaras that talk about that. So the same voice from heaven that came down and said the halacha is like Beit, you know, that the halacha is like Rebbe Eliezer for the Tanur Shalachnai that gets rejected, right? We seem to accept by Hillel's, as, you know, very astutely pointed out. Shalams, could you read Mishnah Brachot 1:3? I think we saw this once before.
Beth Shammai says, in the evening every man should recline and recite the Shema, and in the morning he should stand as it says, and when thou liest down and when thou risest up.
Right, the verse is V'shachbecha v'kumecha. So he reads that literally, that V'shachbecha, when you lie down, means you recite the Kriyat Shema at night lying down. And v'kumecha, when you say it in the morning, you literally have to be standing up.
Beth Hillel, however, says that every man should recite it in his own way, as it says, and when thou walkest by the way. And why then is it said, when thou liest down and when thou risest up? This means at the time when people lie down and at the time when people rise up. Rabbi Tafran said, I was once walking by the way, and I reclined to recite the Shema in the manner prescribed by Beth Shammai, and I incurred danger from robbers. They said to him, you deserve to come to harm because you acted against the opinion of Beth Hillel.
Yeah, and the Gemara is actually even more stricter on this. Like, you know, see how much more strict that the rabbinic laws are than the biblical laws, because if he didn't say Kriyat Shema at all, he just wouldn't have done a biblical commandment. But because he went against Beit Shammai, he was actually worthy of death. Right? So there's a really significant consequence here, right, at the end result of not following one or the other. But there's a very important caveat here. Remember what I said, like the whole bat kol in terms of one picking another? Dayan, take a Gemara in Shabbat 15a.
But were the rabbis so well informed that they knew that?
No, no. If you lie down in the middle of a street back in the day, you were going to get killed.
Got to be out of your mind.
That was the problem.
Who was they said to him?
Oh, not the robbers. These when Rabbi Tarfon is telling over the story to other people. Hey, this is what happened to me, and everyone else like, well, you deserved it. Your own fault. Dayan, take Shabbat 15a.
Hillel said, "A handful of drawn water renders the mikvah unfit, for one must stay to the victim." In his teacher's phraseology.
Yeah, the fact that he used a hin as opposed to other units of measurement. That's what that last line is about. Yeah.
Shammai maintained 9 calves.
Meaning one used the term hin, the other used calf for the same unit of measurement. That's what it meant in terms of the teachers. But continue, the sages?
But the sages ruled neither as one nor the other until 2 weavers came from the dung gate of Jerusalem and testified on the authority of Shemaiah and
Aftalion,
that 3 logs of drawn water render a mikvah unfit. And the sages ratified their words.
Isn't that fascinating here? You know, you always think of like Hillel and Shammai as a duality, you know, as a one or the other. But here, according to this Gemara, there was actually a debate, and the sages didn't like either one. At least whatever this collective was, rejected both opinions. And you had someone else that came from Shmaya and Avtalion, one of the great pairs who brought the older tradition, saying this is what, you know, we learned from them. It's like, you know what? We're going to do what you say. So it's not just a matter of Shammai versus Hillel, as much as what was the legislative process that underscored everything. And part of the basis for that seems to be, or at least in this case, who had the better tradition. Not just so much the better logic, but you can go further back and get what the real halacha is. Doesn't matter I've got Shammai, doesn't matter I've got Hillel on either side, however great that you are, we got something better. And
they
it was ultimately...
They proceeded. Exactly,
yeah. And that was the final decision that was made. Mm. Right? Through an act of legislation, Chazal actually rejected Hillel and Shammai. Fascinating, fascinating Gemara. Dana.
That's an unusual phrase, the better tradition. What does that mean?
By a better tradition, meaning, let's put it this way. What Shammai and Hillel can do is you can argue from logic. When you say that this is what I got from Shmaya Valf Talion, right, it's not so much, I mean, better tradition is a weird phrase, but when you say, like, this is what I got from my teacher, like, this is the way back up, and you assume people don't lie about it, which is not such a great assumption today, because, well, lying is a harsh word. I'm sure there's some people who actually lie about what their teachers say. It's not uncommon for people to be mistaken, or for people to misrepresent their teachers' views in ways that are more in line with what they'd like their rabbi to have said. That's a little bit more tactful. Okay, we'll go with that. But we're assuming that back in the day, you know, people just reported stuff as it was. Like, you know, hey, this is what I got. And there are a few other cases in the Gemara of like, yes, this is what I received. There's a case even involving Hillel in Pesachim. Where he said, oh, you know, he did Shemush with Shmaya Valtalion, he forgot something and was reminded of it later, but there was something of like, if this is what you learned from your teacher, then, and you can give like legit testimony that this is what happened. And sometimes someone who doesn't know any better can give you a better testimony. Because if someone asks, well, what did so and so do? You know, you'd almost call it Mesiach Lefi Tumo, which means you give over from a state of purity. I know that's not the exact idiom here, but it's someone doesn't know any better to lie. You know, it's like, well, he did this, he did that, he did that. You don't know what details are important or unimportant. You can ask about it. It's like, well, there was that, there was that. You don't know what the consequences are of your actions. You won't know what to misrepresent, right?
But we do that today.
What do you mean?
This is what my Rebbe said.
Yeah, so the example I give for this is Rav Soloveitchik, because Rav Soloveitchik is one of those rabbis where people recreate Rav Soloveitchik in their own image. Just for like some people will portray him as like this grand modern Orthodox communal rabbi, others as a philosopher king. And my favorite representation came from his funeral, where someone said, I never saw Rav Soloveitchik with a secular book. Now, this is someone who wrote a PhD in philosophy in German. You know, his first footnote is Rudolf. No, it's a true statement. I have no, I have no doubt. I will not impugn him at all.
Right,
to
he
say
never
that
saw him, so
he never saw it. Right,
he's now, probably blind as a bat.
But you also know it could very well be he never, in fact, saw him with a secular book. Yeah. But Ein Lo Ra'inu Ra'aya, which we'll get to at a later point too. The fact that you didn't see it doesn't mean that's not true. But even if it was factually true, right, you're giving a representation of Rav Soloveitchik, where that's just not accurate to who he actually was. I had a discussion like this with one of my Talmud professors, where we were going through a particular sugya, and he thought that there was some textual problem in the text of the Gemara, because you had two students that came out of one teacher who said the exact opposite things. And he said, that seems a little strange. I raised my hand. It's like, but what about Rav Soloveitchik? He looked at me, he thought for a bit, and he like scribbled in his notes to change. That's what happens. Anyway, another last section here is a fascinating quirk with the whole thing about majority rule, and that is public acceptance. What happens, based in rule something, and people just don't care? Dana, Gemara Sanhedrin 5a.
Coming here, Marzutra, the son of Rav Nachman, judged the case alone and gave an erroneous decision. On appearing before Rav Yosef, he was told, if both parties accepted you as their judge, you are not liable to make restitution. Otherwise, go and indemnify the injured party. Hence, it can be inferred that the judgment of one, though not authorized, is valid.
So, on a local level, right, if I accept that the rulings of so-and-so, that has a standing of halacha, even though if lechatchila initially, right, not necessarily true, if both parties agree, we're going to follow someone's decisions, the fact of communal acceptance can bestow a certain degree of authority. By the same token, finish us off with Gemara Avodah Zarah 35.
Ullah said, when an ordinance is made in Palestine, its reason is not revealed before a full year passes, lest there be some who might not agree with the reason and would treat the ordinance lightly.
Yeah, this is, we discussed this in our shiur on kosher cheese, and like why we never got a straight answer out of this, but there was actually a legitimate concern of people didn't spread, you know, not the cheese, but they didn't actually spread around the reasons. Because if people said like, hey, we're making this enactment because such and such a reason, lo and behold, people wouldn't necessarily do it. They might have had a certain trust in the rabbis, but like up until a point, you give them a little more ammo to say, well, this isn't a reason, that's not a reason. Their authority is not going to be nearly as binding, in which case they don't really do much. Hmm. All right? So, what do we take away from all this? Major component, in fact, the most major component of the halachic process, is the legislative process, when Chazal enacts certain laws. We saw from the thing with Hillel and Prisbal, it is only this group that has the authority to enact laws that are binding on all of the Jewish people. And the difference would be, something that's binding on the Jewish people, or at least real halacha, is binding across all time and space, as opposed to just a particular group of people. Additionally, once you have that type of legislation in place, it is the law until another court can come and overturn it. Now, people have argued that that means that, you know, our halacha is frozen. And in some cases, it most certainly is. Because until such a body gets reconstituted, no rabbi has the halachic authority, based on the system set up by the Gemara, to overturn a previous decree. And I say that because there are people who do argue with it and throw in a whole bunch of other nuances. The point here is that according to the halachic system set up by the Gemara, based on everything else that we saw before, you need the legislative process to overturn another court. You can have other rulings, right? But they may not carry that same binding nature unless it was ratified by some court for the entire Jewish people. Now, you need the bigger and better Beit Din to overturn, but not to enact newer stuff. For that, you would just need some court decision. But if it was only supposed to be for a limited basis, it wouldn't necessarily be obligatory on anyone else. Yeah.
When the Beis Din argued, what system of logic did they use? I mean, when you look at evidence, you have to posit a certain process. Mm-hmm. Process is a logical body of reasoning.
Yeah, so because we don't have explicit records, it's hard to say. What we do have, and this is where the Gemara comes in handy. The Gemara, how to put this, you have a lot of statements where one rabbi said this, one rabbi said that. The stuff in the Gemara that's anonymous Aramaic is often called the Stam, or the redactor, that throws in logic that weaves together all of these rabbinic statements. And those, it's from there that you can sort of extrapolate what was rabbinic logic. So a few things might be, if it's based on a biblical verse, how did you read some verses? Kal v'chomer, some analogies. You might have random takanot, random decree saying, well, this isn't a situation, here's what I'm decreeing now, which is a way of saying it's not what the law ought, this isn't innately part of, say, biblical law that I'm extrapolating, this is something new I'm coming up with because this is what we need, like the prizbol, right? That was something that Hillel just, came up with. As opposed to how do two people read certain biblical verses? How do two people understand the reality of a situation?
Okay, for example, the Torah says do not cook a kid in its mother's milk.
Yeah.
So how do they reason that a cow was included, that a chicken was included?
Well, the chicken comes in. So the chicken comes in later. So their means of analogy and the means of analogy would be the best way that I could put it.
Greek logic?
Syllogistic? I suppose. That's where it gets really harder to peg down. Because even if you rely on the Stam, it's hard to say whether or not the people themselves, or by meaning the Tanaim and the Amoraim, actually held that way, or is that just the Stam making its best guess? All right? So that can be where things are complicated, because the logic that's weaved in and out could very well be an anachronism. Maybe that is what they meant, maybe it's not. It's why you have certain scholars will make that distinction between what's attributed, and specifically the unattributed Aramaic lines of the Talmud, you take with a different grain of salt than with the others, because that's, quote, the Gemara, as opposed to what Tanaim and Amoraim said. That could just be the redactor's best understanding. So the answer is maybe.
But they came at the time when Greeks were, their mathematics and their logic were flourishing, beginning of a completed logic system. Did they know about it? Did they use it?
Well, it's clear some had, that gets into like Chochma Yevanit.
The 13 principles of interpretation that we say every morning.
Yeah. But that's more of an exegetical thing than a Greek logic system. And for that, it's really hard to know what did they know, and it's even harder to know would they actually use it, and if they used it, were they doing it consciously, or is that just part of the worldview what everyone was doing, right? These are fantastic questions. I'm sure you could find some evidence in the Gemara of Greek logic being used, but it's unless you, hire a psychic, who can go way, way, way back, you'd never really know what went on in their heads. The best we have is just the recording of it. All right. Thank you all very much. See you next week. And for those paying attention, our weekday class has now moved to Wednesdays at 8 o'clock. We're doing current Jewish questions, dealing with a lot of contemporary issues, mostly in Jewish law, but we'll probably get to some theology at some point. This week, I believe we're doing art in Judaism, certain laws of art when they come up. So anyone who's interested in art or things that might see you on Wednesday.